Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, NUI Galway is asking you to lend a helping hand to hedgehogs.
So we're having a volunteer survey. So we're asking people to get involved in surveying for hedgehogs in their area. So they will do this using footprint tunnels. So these are little corrugated tunnels and they have some paper and ink and some food in them. And if hedgehogs go into the tunnel, they leave their footprints on the way out. And that tells us if hedgehogs are there or not.
An astute listener in West Cork poses an interesting question about how goldfinches communicate.
Hi Derek, I have attached two recordings of a goldfinch in Gugambara in recent days. The first recording is your usual lovely cheerful chirp that you actually get. But the second recording is what we did for social media. And the question I actually have for you and your panel and your audience is the second recording how goldfinches actually converse with each other? And that is the sound that we can't actually hear because it is a very, very different sound. Thank you.
And it was a big weekend for bird lovers around the world. Yesterday was International Dawn Chorus Day. And once again, RTE Radio was at the fore of broadcasting Nature Symphony.
You're listening to the annual broadcast live of the Dawn Chorus from Cuscany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove in County Cork in the southwest of Ireland. I want to say hello once again to all of our listeners right across Europe, courtesy of the European Broadcasting Union, to our Celtic cousins on the Isle of Man, Cornwall, in Brittany and France, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, because our partners in BBC Radio Ulster, BBC Scotland and BBC Wales have joined us for this very special Celtic-themed dawn chorus this morning. There were times during the early hours of Sunday morning I was shivering. But I want to say a very special thank you to everybody who worked on the programme. It was really terrific. And then from 5 a.m. onwards, that wonderful dawn chorus which rang out from Cuscany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove all over the world, thanks to your National Broadcasting Service, RTE Radio. This is the 26th year, in some manner, shape or form, that we have broadcast the Dawn Chorus. People say to me, it can't be 26 years. Well, Mooney Goes Wild is on air 26 years in May, as it happens. So it is indeed the 26th year that in some manner, shape or form, we have featured the Dawn Chorus. Not always as big as yesterday morning, but that's the way it goes. You build up to things. And it was terrific to be joined by our Celtic cousins, BBC Radio Ulster, BBC Scotland and BBC Wales. And we had reporters on the Isle of Man, in Brittany and France, very charming indeed, and also in Cornwall. And we spoke during the morning about our Celtic connections. We mentioned the chough, which is known as the Celtic bird. In fact, it appears on Cornwall's coat of arms. Indeed, one prominent nationalist said when a breeding pair was discovered in 2002, thought to be from either Ireland or Britain, that the re-emergence of the chough is a symbol of the re-emergence of the Cornish nation. Now put that in your pipe and smoke it, as they say. But we also spoke about the culture, the folklore and the music in the guise of two of Ireland's greats, Donal Lunny and Paddy Glacken, who delighted us during the early hours of the morning with some Celtic and bird-themed tunes.
Well, thank you very much, Derek. That was indeed a very, very interesting programme about the Curlew. I don't know, Donal, whether you've had much experience of the Curlew in your growing up around Newbridge or wherever.
Yes, in Newbridge, but I would say more particularly in Donegal, because beyond the sea there, you know, Curlew would be feeding on the strands. The plaintive call of the Curlew is a lovely thing in itself, that long note, rising note. It's such a shock that the Curlew has vanished to such an extent that it's, what, 90-something percent down. That's a real collapse.
Yeah, I love the sound of the Curlew myself when I'm out walking in Clontarf. particularly when, you know, when the tide is out and you hear the curlew. And indeed, a great friend of ours many years ago, John Kelly, he was a great man for the curlew. He used to always say that the certain music had a call of the curlew in it.
Oh, brilliant.
Maybe we'll play a tune dedicated to the curlew. It's called The Curlew Reel, and we'll follow it with another tune called The Bird in the Bush. But The Curlew Reel itself was composed by a great fiddle player and piano player by the name of Josephine Keegan.
Ah, yes.
So, right, we'll give it a go.
Great.
Thank you, Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny. And we'll have more music from Paddy and Donal before the programme is over. Aren't they just the perfect accompaniment to the birds singing in the early morning, you have to admit? Beautiful music. Now let's say hello to Richard Collins and Niall Hatch. Niall is in Wicklow. Richard was broadcasting from his home in Malahide during the morning. Richard, did you enjoy the dawn chorus?
I enjoyed it very much, Derek. It is a milestone and it is a very fine contribution, I always think, to our knowledge of birds, because perhaps in 100 years from now, people will dig out the recordings from Kushkini and everywhere else, and they will have an insight into what birds were here 100 years previously and what birds have gone. It's a very interesting thing. These are records of great value, I think.
Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland is in his home now in County Wicklow. Niall was part, as you know, of the presentation team live from Kuskinny Marsh during the dawn chorus. Niall, do you want to add anything to what Richard has said?
I completely agree with Richard. I think it really is fascinating to have this record stretching back now over a couple of decades of how the birds in Ireland sounded, what species were present. And what I think will also be very interesting is to see over the centuries, well, I won't see it, but future ornithologists will, how bird songs may have changed. Perhaps dialects would have shifted with birds at that stage. Perhaps new species will have arrived, will have a completely different dawn chorus. So it really does represent a really interesting snapshot. I think, you know, hats off to all at RTÉ and Mooney Goes Wild for making that possible, because this really is a part of the historical record. The recording of birdsong is actually less than a century old. This time, 100 years ago, nobody was recording bird sounds, so we don't know really how birds sounded, even in the relatively recent past, in the grand scheme of things. I mean, 100 years in bird terms, from an evolutionary point of view, is nothing. Who knows how birds sounded 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago? Well, at least future generations will know. And because it's been done so consistently, people may even be able to analyse them, see changes from year to year, may be able to look back with a hindsight that, of course, we don't have at the moment to see just how important these were. It's one of my favourite things of the year to do as well, I have to say. I thoroughly enjoyed it at the weekend as well. Really fun to get out to listen to the birds and to just immerse myself in nature like that. There's something I get from it that's like nothing else. It just really leaves me feeling very uplifted. I'm buzzing for the rest of the day after something like that, and I hope our listeners were as well. It was really very special.
Well, judging by the feedback we got during the morning and subsequently, people certainly were buzzing, and they can continue on that high because the Dawn Chorus singers will keep performing right into June, Niall.
They will. So the Dawn Chorus isn't something that happens just on one day. I mean, I remember once someone asked us the question during the programme, how do you know that the birds were going to do the Dawn Chorus that particular morning? Well, of course, they do it for a period of several weeks, and this will continue right through May and into June. And then from sort of early to mid-June, it starts to die down a bit. The birds will still sing. Then by July, as a big phenomenon, it's more or less over, though the birds will still sing. So anytime over the next few weeks is ideal to get out and listen to it and experience it for yourself. And hopefully from listening to the programme at the weekend or listening back to the archives at rte.ie/Mooney, people will be able to try and learn some of those bird songs and calls, get to know the role that each bird plays in the particular Dawn Chorus orchestra, and to see maybe how their local birds might differ from the ones that we had from Kuskany Marsh or from other parts of Ireland, or indeed the other countries that we broadcasted from at the weekend.
Lovely stuff, Niall. We'll bring you a snapshot, just a sample of the birdsong uninterrupted towards the end of the programme for about 10 minutes or thereabouts. But let's move on with today's show. You can email mooney@rte.ie and visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. We're going to continue on the theme of bird vocalisations. This audio came in from Neil Lucy, who lives in Googan Barra in West Cork.
Hi Derek, I have attached two recordings of a goldfinch in Googan Barra in recent days. The first recording is your usual lovely cheerful chirp that you actually get. But the second recording is what we did for social media. And we did that actually in slow-mo, so the sound is way slower, way more in-depth, and a very, very, very different sound. And the question I actually have for you and your panel and your audience is the second recording how goldfinches actually converse with each other? And that is the sound that we can't actually hear because it is a very, very different sound. Thank you.
Derek, that is a very interesting recording, a very clean recording, I think, isn't it, of the call of a goldfinch. It's a very musical call. Now, a number of things have to be taken into consideration if you slow a call, a recording down, because the pitch will fall. The number of waves passing a point in a second is called the frequency, and if you slow it down, then the number of waves slows down and the pitch slows down. So what you're hearing the second time bears no relation to what a goldfinch might be hearing. Now, there is a huge difference in the ears of us and the ears of a bird, because in our case, the eardrum, which vibrates when the sound comes into the ear, it connects to three little bones in us. The three little bones amplify the vibration into a thing called the cochlea, which actually does the next phase of the operation. Now, in a bird, there aren't three bones, There's only one. So it's a much reduced ear. And it's not surprising then that birds have a much more limited range of frequencies. They hear fewer frequencies than we do. Most birds, 1,000 hertz to about 5,000 hertz is where they operate. In our case, it's 20 hertz all the way up to 18,000 hertz. And you remember Simon Barrow last week talking about the whales working on 38,000 hertz for the pulses in whales. So creatures hear at different speeds, hear at different frequencies. So what the bird hears and what we hear is entirely different. And remember, sound isn't real. What we hear isn't real. It is something our nervous systems have created, a kind of virtual reality corresponding to the range of vibrations coming in and the patterns within those vibrations. It's an unreal thing in a way, but it does correspond to something real in the world, and that is patterns in sound waves entering. Now, what a goldfinch would create is bound to be very different from what we create in our nervous systems.
But Neil is asking, is the goldfinch hearing the slowed down sound? Is that how it actually communicates? Or is it hearing what we're hearing, the speeded up or the normal speed of sound that we're hearing?
Well, now, speed is relative. It's relative. We are working at, say, heartbeat, at 72 beats a minute, roughly, is what we do. Something like a mouse, which is much smaller, is working at 1,000 beats. Beats a minute. A sparrow is working at around 620 something beats per minute. So, in other words, in the world of the goldfinch, which is about sparrow size, everything is moving much faster relative to us. What looks like 10 seconds to us, it might be several minutes to a goldfinch. So what it's actually hearing, its world is moving, a kind of theory of relativity. Time and space are relative in physics, and time and space are relative in zoology as well. A whale, for instance, has only a few heartbeats in a minute. Its world is much slower relative to ours. The humpback whale's song is about 20 minutes long. In his world, 20 minutes probably corresponds to the length a goldfinch would be singing. We just don't know because we're locked into our own subjective little worlds and we can't envisage it. We have to try and infer what might be going on.
Yes, Richard, I think it's a really fascinating topic. Birds almost certainly perceive the world both by hearing and by vision in a very different way to the way that we do. And that, of course, probably varies greatly from bird species to bird species. So as you said, most birds, they hear higher frequency range generally than we would be skewed towards. But then, of course, some birds like the bittern that has a very, very deep, low call and song, that actually must hear in a lower frequency range. And then obviously there's animals like elephants that hear below what the human ear can hear. So it's very different throughout the natural world. Now, in terms of how this goldfinch is actually perceiving this sound, this is something that we can't tell. We can't get into its head. Same way with Tige the crow, we can't get into his head to see what he's thinking. What's happening is, you know, somehow there's information being communicated between the goldfinches. And when you hear that slowed down recording, you can tell that there's a lot more information in that sound than would immediately meet the human ear. It's only when it's slowed down for us that we can perceive it. But presumably the goldfinches must be able to perceive that naturally. Whether they're just more sensitive to those frequencies and therefore hear all the nuances and all the pitch shifts, or whether they genuinely perceive it as actually happening in a slower time frame than it does for us humans, we don't know. But it would seem that there's some information that's important to those birds being communicated there. I think what's really impressive as well is when you hear it slowed down, and also when you see it on a spectrogram, which would be a pictorial representation of the sounds, it shows that actually the frequency sweep that goldfinch is going through is really quite wide. It's going from some very high notes to very low notes in a very short space of time. And that's far beyond the ability of human vocal cords. Of course, the way that birds produce sound is more efficient than it is for us humans, or indeed for any of our fellow mammals, because we have a larynx, a voice box with vocal cords in it that vibrate. For birds, they have a syrinx or a syrinx, which is two tubes that are controlled with the muscles in the side that make them wider or narrower. And it's a more efficient way for them to rapidly switch between frequencies. And also also what studies have shown, particularly of a bird called the Northern Cardinal in North America, is that they can actually use one side of the syrinx, one of the tubes for the low pitch and the other side for the high pitch, switch seamlessly between them in sort of a slur. And I know that for the cardinal, it can actually go a greater frequency range than a piano, more notes and more pitch than a piano, which is something that the human voice could never do. Not even the most supremely accomplished opera singer could even get close to that. These birds do it without thinking. And for the first time ever in that recording there, I can hear the goldfinch doing something similar. I think it would be fascinating to hear what more birds and other wild creatures sound like when they're slowed down, because it probably does get closer to what they're experiencing. And then, of course, the next task for ornithologists would be to try and decipher what they're saying. It's becoming clearer and clearer that many birds do have some form of what we might term language. They are conveying some sort of important information to each other. And in that call that we heard of the goldfinch there, if it was just a warning of danger in a generic sense, there'd be no reason for it to be so complex and so complicated there. There's a lot going on in that very short little sound. So it stands to reason, I would argue, that there must be some important information being conveyed there. Just we can't understand what it is.
You mention the bittern and the elephant, Niall. Now, they need to communicate over very great distances. The bittern can be heard 5 kilometres away on a quiet evening. Now, to get that kind of distance into your signal, you need to use very low frequencies, the lowest you can get away with. Now, in the case of the goldfinch, he's only interested in communicating with something which may be 100, 200 meters away, something like that, at most. So he can select much higher frequencies. Frequency is in short supply. The spectrum is very limited, and all the birds are trying to get their little slot. In the world of radio broadcasting, the International Telecommunications Union in Geneva is the watchdog for all the species allocated around the world. They have to match everyone's needs to the frequencies available. So it's the same, in a sense, in the bird world. Now, an interesting thing you mentioned there was North America. The famous bird for this is the whippoorwill. The whippoorwill is a bird which has 3 syllables to our ears. Whippoorwill. Now, actually, there is a 4th syllable, a short syllable, whippoorwill, which is very brief. Interestingly, starlings mimic birds, and when starlings were introduced to the United States, they started mimicking whippoorwills, and when their recording of the whippoorwill, their version of the whippoorwill, this extra syllable is still in there, is in there again, in a sense, but we can't hear it. So the starling is working on a timescale sufficiently fast that it can detect this. We are not. We are much slower.
Fascinating things, really, and a lot more being discovered all the time. A good friend of mine works in the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology in their Macaulay Library of Natural Sounds in New York, and his whole life is about recording birds, processing the signals, and I know that he's been doing some interesting things, slowing them down and seeing what happens. And what was really mind-blowing for me, I remember a few years ago, he played me the recording of a species of wren. It sounded very similar to our wren here in Europe. It's called a winter wren. It's kind of the counterpart to our Eurasian wren. It sings a very similar song. And as soon as I heard the song at normal speed, it sounded instantly like a wren. I knew immediately it was a wren species. But then he slowed it down very considerably, and obviously that lowered the pitch quite remarkably, so it became much deeper, and it became incredibly similar to the song of the humpback whale. So two species that obviously aren't going to be confused with each other in nature, but obviously singing for similar purposes. And that song of the wren is so complex, it must be conveying some information there. There's just so much going on. And when it's slowed down, you hear that even more. There are hundreds of notes crammed into just the span of a couple of seconds, going up and down the scale, spanning many octaves. And it's just going on all around us. And because it's not designed with us in mind, the wren or the humpback whale or indeed the goldfinch, they don't care what human beings think of what they're saying. They're not trying to communicate with us. So we miss really what's going on. But to them, it must be very important. And I think it's fascinating. In some ways, it's almost like communicating with alien life, trying to learn their language without really having any dictionary or any rule books. So I'm looking forward. I'm sure there'll be huge breakthroughs in the years to come. It's a really burgeoning area of research.
Niall, can you hear the grasshopper warbler? One of the most interesting bird songs of all is that of the grasshopper warbler. It sounds like a cricket, a continuous fisherman's reel, reeling sound in open area, marshy area, that kind of thing. Now, this brings back unhappy memories for me, because my father and I used to go bird watching when he was about 60 years of age. And we would stand very close to a grasshopper warbler, and I would hear it clearly, loudly, and I'm saying, "Dad, can you not hear that?" And he couldn't. Now, the tables are turned. The poor man is dead long ago. But I have grandchildren now that I want to introduce to a grasshopper warbler sound. But I can't find it to start with. You'll have to help me there, Niall, and advise me where I might go to hear a grasshopper warbler. Even though I can't hear it, where my grandchildren could hear it.
Well, by sheer coincidence, I was listening to my first grasshopper warbler of the year just this very morning. It was singing away at Brodachurn's East Coast Nature Reserve in Newcastle and County Wicklow. Just arrived from Africa, a recently arrived migrant. And as you know, Richard, it's a bird that is very, very hard to see. This bird this morning was tucked deep inside some brambles and a gorse bush. And I got a few glimpses of it flitting between bramble patches. But anytime it was singing, it was really tucked into cover. All I could hear was that remarkable song, this very rapid ticking, like someone letting out a fishing reel. It's a really mechanical sound. And I'm pleased to say that I can indeed still hear that. And I could hear the goldcrest singing nearby too, another one of our highest pitched songs. But the interesting thing about the grasshopper warbler is when they run sonograms of these to show what's happening with the song, we're only hearing part of it. So even the human with all of their hearing faculties, who can hear every pitch that within normal hearing range, all we hear is that ticking noise. But it seems what's happening with the grasshopper warbler, with the other side of their syrinx, what they're doing is producing another even higher pitched sort of cheep or whistle note every so often during that reeling, and to the human ear it's completely inaudible, so we can't hear it, but the birds can. So if someone was recording the grasshopper warbler and playing the sound back, if the recording equipment they were using, the microphone or whatever the compressors were or whatever, if they weren't set to a high enough frequency, if you played it back to the grasshopper warbler, you'd be missing half the song and it wouldn't even recognise what it was. So we don't necessarily perceive the sound the way that the birds do at all. And while I can certainly hear what we can normally hear of the grasshopper warbler, there's a whole part of that song that's completely hidden to my ears.
Thank you very much indeed, Niall and Richard. I think we'll have a little bit more music now from Paddy Glacken and Donna Lunny. This was first broadcast during our Dawn Chorus Celtic theme special yesterday morning between 1 and 7 a.m.
Well, thanks, Derek. Donal and myself are still here in Studio 8. Again, I thought it was a fascinating programme about the eider duck. Donal, do you know anything about eider ducks?
No more than that. If a fox got hold of one, there wouldn't be much left except the feathers.
Right. And it's just interesting that they live out on islands as a kind of a protection.
Well, yeah, then that's right off the land.
Yeah, to stay out of the range of the fox.
Yes, indeed. Foxes aren't great.
And of course, then we have the old eiderdown quilts as well, which is... Kind of an item of luxury.
Sheer luxury. An awful lot of eiderdown feathers must go into them.
Anyway, we'll play a few tunes. Why don't we honour the fox?
Ah, sure, why not?
Why not? And of course, the fox occupies a very, very special place in the music. And there's a great tune, a great descriptive piece, which was written not very politically correct in today's world, but it's a tune called The Fox Chase, and we're going to play two little segments out of it. One is the slip jig version and the second one is the double jig version of Shall I Go Wather Dooa.
Let her out there.
Paddy Glagan and Donal Lunny in Studio 8 taking part in the annual broadcast of the Dawn Chorus. We'll come back to them again before the programme is over. Now, the humble hedgehog may not be native to our shores, but it has long been held in great affection in its adopted home. However, despite their wide distribution across the country, there is a dearth of information on the species here. Studies from the UK, however, and Europe show numbers are in steep decline, largely due to habitat loss. But what about Ireland? Well, here's where you, our listeners, come in. That's right, folks. Researchers at NUI Galway and the National Biodiversity Data Centre are asking you to take on the role of citizen scientists and help out with the second nationwide hedgehog survey. Last year we spoke with PhD candidate Elaine O'Riordan from the Zoology Department at NUI Galway on the first survey, and earlier she joined us from Galway to give Aina an update.
So we're having a volunteer survey, so we're asking people to get involved in surveying for hedgehogs in their area. So they will do this using footprint tunnels. So these are little corrugated tunnels, and they have some paper and ink and some food in them. And if hedgehogs go into the tunnel, they leave their footprints on the way out, and that tells us if hedgehogs are there or not. And we're doing this so that we can get an idea of how our Irish hedgehog population is getting on.
And how healthy is the population of hedgehogs in Ireland?
There's never been kind of any national survey or a national census of hedgehogs in Ireland. You know, they appear to be widespread and fairly common, but we don't know really. But we do know that from other countries in Europe that there has been fairly steep declines over the last 10, 15 years. So that's why we want to do this survey now, to see what our population is like, to give us a baseline so we can measure in future if we think that there is a decline in the population.
Hello, Elaine. It's great to talk to you, because you have launched this hedgehog survey last year, and this is now the second year of it. So the COVID effect, if you like, with people being at home all the time, surely has given you great results, given that hedgehogs really, really live in people's gardens and people have nothing else to do, only look at their gardens for a year. So how did it go last year?
Yeah, we had some really fantastic and interesting results. So we had over 2,000 people submitted records, or over 2,000 records submitted for the whole country last year. So that was phenomenal, because normally any given year you might have 300 to 400, you know, on a good year. So that was a great result. It was interesting as well, because one of the things that we found this year was that many of the results, the sightings were actually of live animals. About 75% of them were live animal sightings, which is unusual as well, and only about 17%, I think, were actually roadkill. And normally, to be the other way around, you'd be seeing probably around 60 to 70% roadkill and maybe only around 30% live animal sightings.
The survey was a real project that people who are at home with a family perhaps would love to engage in. So as well as observing your garden and seeing could you find any hedgehogs, you had a wonderful thing, I thought it was great, whereby you had a tunnel and you had ink and you had the hedgehog walking through the tunnel and the ink and leaving inky footprints. It looked a great experiment. Did people do that, and did they get inky footprints?
They did. Now, quite a lot of people did it. They already knew they had hedgehogs in their garden, so it was fantastic. And some people did, and they sent photographs of the footprints and everything. So we had a good few now. I think we had about 50 or 60 people did it. And some people as well used trail cameras as well. And so we got some lovely footage of hedgehogs in people's gardens and stuff like that. So we're hoping now to carry on that survey this year so that people will be able to do that again. And but also to kind of expand it so that people can do a larger survey. So they'll take a kilometre square area and they'll put out 10 tunnels for 5 nights. And that will help give us more information then about the wider countryside and larger areas, to see where the hedgehogs are living and where they're not, and what kind of habitats they're in.
Now, you were saying at one point that if you see a hedgehog during the day, it's probably not a well hedgehog. So that this really is a survey that's carried out once dusk comes. Or did that actually prove to be true? Were all of these results found by people out at night, or were there more daytime things? And is it true that a hedgehog out in the day is really not well and shouldn't really be out and about at all?
Yeah, it's funny. I do get plenty of records of people saying they see hedgehogs out in the day. So if you see, the kind of rule of thumb is if you see a hedgehog out during the day, if it's moving around and it's fairly lively looking, it's usually okay. But if they're wobbling or falling over or lying down, or if there's flies buzzing around it, it's usually a sign that they're not well. So sometimes females and stuff, particularly nesting females, might need that extra little bit of a top up of food and stuff, and animals just out of hibernation. So they'll come out during the day sometimes to get nesting material or get food. But a lot of the times, if you see a hedgehog lying lazing around during the day, that's not a well hedgehog.
Helene, I would love the opportunity to knock some sense into hedgehogs. The poor old things, they are here longer than any other mammal in Ireland, except for the pygmy shrew. They're a relative. But they have a medieval mindset. When danger threatens, they curl into a ball and put out their spikes. And this has served them very well. But when it comes to traffic, and they're out in the middle of the road and a car light shines down, the car is a couple of hundred yards away, the hedgehog rolls into a ball and is crushed. Now, this is a very agile animal. If only a small section of the hedgehog community would cop on to run for a bit before they curl up, that strain of hedgehog behaviour would survive ecologically. They need a training course. Their brains are very small for a mammal their size, but you'd really love to have them a good shake and say, for God's sake, will you cop yourself on? There's no need to roll into a ball when the car comes.
Well, I suppose maybe hedgehog evolution probably moves a bit slower than human technology development. That's for sure. Yeah, it's awful to see them getting squashed on the road and getting knocked down. Although there have been some studies, I think in the Netherlands, that have shown that hedgehogs are beginning to learn to kind of, you know, when they meet a road, to walk along it now, not to go across it. But yes, it is a pity that they do roll up. The old rolling up into a ball has served them very well for millennia, you know, to avoid interactions with foxes and other animals. But it doesn't work very well against traffic, I'm afraid.
They're rather solitary souls. They don't go in much for coffee mornings or going to the pub. They seem to keep well away from each other. And the female wears a kind of another medieval trick. She has a kind of chastity belt. He can't get in unless she flattens her spines. So this is a medieval species in more ways than one. Now, what is limiting the hedgehog population? Are the number of males being reduced too much because they're the vulnerable ones on the roads because they wander around so much? Is that the factor? Is poor breeding success likely to be a factor? Or is it straight mortality from other causes?
I think it's a mixture of things. One of the main causes that's been cited anyway from the UK and from Europe, where there's been more work done on it, is habitat loss and habitat fragmentation, you know. So the suitable habitats are getting scarcer and more widely spaced apart. So the declines in hedgehogs numbers have been much larger in rural areas, where we've seen the biggest changes in land use, you know, from kind of traditional smaller scale farming to bigger, more intensive commercial farming operations. So the loss of habitats like hedgerows and scrub and areas of kind of traditional grassland management, that has had an impact now on the hedgehogs. The numbers haven't been as bad in suburban areas and villages and stuff like that, because there's still a good mixture of habitats in between people's gardens and parks and things like that.
Now, your tunnels that you're putting down, it seems to me, for looking at it as a layman from the outside, that they would tell you whether hedgehogs are present or not, but they wouldn't be much use in telling you how many there are. I believe what happens is the hedgehog goes in, there's some ink, it gets on its feet, and there's a paper, and a trail is made of ink marks of its feet, and from that you deduce that a hedgehog has been in. But rats and squirrels and mice, all kinds of things will be in and out. And the same hedgehog may go back and forth a few times. So can you estimate at all how many hedgehogs have entered the tunnel? Or is it just yes or no that you can say?
No. The footprint tunnels are purely just a way of measuring presence or absence. That'll tell us the kind of habitats where they do occur, where they don't. That will tell us a lot of information. But what I plan to do to follow up then is that I will look at doing kind of population density studies. So the technique that I'm hoping to use for that will be to use camera traps. So there's a method where you can set up several camera traps, and that will help you to estimate then the number of hedgehogs that occur in different kinds of habitats. So that'll be the kind of follow-up work that I'll be doing as well after the presence-absence survey.
Traps won't work well where there's a path that the animals tend to take, as with badgers, for instance. So you put the camera up. Now, are there such tracks in the hedgehog world? Do they tend to go along routine paths and so on, so that you can put your camera up and find out very soon how many there are in the vicinity? Or do they just go everywhere and anywhere at random?
They do tend to wamble around the place wherever the notion takes them. Now, they do stay within vague home range area, and they'll maintain several day nests within that area, but they can wander 1 to 2 kilometres in the night looking for food. But they certainly do cop on to where food is, you know, and if there's people putting food out, they will come back, and usually at kind of the same time every evening people will report that the hedgehogs will appear when they know the food goes out. And even seasonally as well, they know that, for example, you know, at certain times of the year there'll be more insects and maybe the arable land, and then there'll be you know, when the crops have been cut, and there'll be more insects in other areas at other times. So they do move around, but they do kind of have an idea of where they're going as well.
Elaine, the hedgehogs are coming out of hibernation now, I suppose, in the month of April. So you're not starting this survey until June. Is there a reason for this, or can anybody send you records of hedgehogs that they see once they see them at all in this year?
Oh, absolutely. People can send records all the time, and that is fantastic to keep the records coming. I've had records from Christmas Day even. So the kind of casual recording scheme will carry on absolutely all the time. I'm kind of waiting till June to start the volunteer survey, partly because things have been delayed really with COVID. I suppose ideally I would like to have gotten started in May, but just with everything that was going on and with piles up of other work, it's just going to be that it's June that we actually get it off the ground.
So therefore, if you have hedgehogs in your garden, one way of encouraging them is by feeding them. Can you remind us again what you should give hedgehogs to eat and what you shouldn't give them to eat?
A little bit of extra feeding for hedgehogs is no harm at all, and I'm sure it's very helpful to them. They normally eat insects and worms and slugs and snails and all sorts of little invertebrates. So they need something like cat food or dog food. So it can be the wet stuff or from a can or a packet, or those little dry little small cat biscuits, the kibble. So they'll eat those quite happily. The only thing that we say that not to give them is bread or milk or a lot of fruit, because they can't digest that, and that will actually make them sick. And stuff like peanuts you have to be careful with, because they can get stuck in the roofs of their mouth then and can harm them. Small little pieces of food, or wet cat food or dog food, is the best thing.
Sounds delicious, Elaine. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, thank you very much. Cheerio.
More details on how you can become a citizen scientist and help with that survey on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. You can still keep sending your records in, by the way, of the cuckoo sightings that you're making. Lots of you have done so, and we've passed on the information to Birdwatch Ireland for their Spring Alive campaign. They're also interested in swallows, and guess what? On Saturday afternoon, I was waiting at the National Car Test Centre in Dean's Grange for my car. It passed, by the way, and I could hear this sound. You know what it is, don't you? It's a swallow. My first swallow of the season. Indeed, the year. Now, they normally arrive in late April, early May. And sure enough, it was the 1st of May on Saturday when I saw and heard mine. And the video evidence is on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. So it was a good omen for the broadcast to come. And the weather stayed fine. I was thrilled skinny. Not a single swallow as summer makes, but it certainly made it that morning for us as we broadcast all over the world from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve. I promised at the beginning of the programme that we would bring you some uninterrupted birdsong, and that's what I'm going to do now. So sit back and enjoy the sweet sound of early morning birdsong as broadcast from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve and Cove on RTE Radio 1 yesterday morning. It really was wonderful. My thanks again to Jim Wilson, our local ornithologist and naturalist, who helped us prepare the ground there at Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve for this year's broadcast of the Dawn Course. And indeed, the entire Mooney Goes Wild team, producers, reporters and presenters alike, and our sound engineering team here at RTE, and all of the engineering teams and presentation teams right across the Celtic nations, BBC Radio Ulster, BBC Radio Scotland and BBC Radio Wales. We'll do it all again next year. We leave you with a final piece of music from Paddy Glancan and Donal Lunny. Until next week, goodbye.
Right, this next tune that we're going to play has nothing to do with the programme you've just heard. It's two animals that I put together in my head for writing this tune. I called it the Hedgehog Foxtrot. I see foxes literally every night outside where I live. They've become very common in the city, but they seem to get by. I've seen loads of them around. Right, so.
The Hedgehog's Foxtrot. It's a great name for a tune.
Paddy Glancan and Donal Lunny with the Hedgehog Foxtrot, ending this week's Mooney Goes Wild, which was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.